This is Purple Radio on demand.
Hi, I'm Louis.
And I'm Sam.
And welcome back to another episode of Chalkboard Ultra, investigating some of the most interesting problems in all of mathematics.
What are we doing today, Louis?
Well, I've been told we have another guest in the studio today.
We absolutely do. One of my very good friends, Olivia, is here to talk about... Well, why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Liv. I do psychology here at Durham, and I'm here to talk about some statistics in psychology.
Ooh,
that sounds very interesting, yeah.
Probably more for you, Louis.
Yeah, there's definitely lots of stories and warnings, I think you can tell, with statistics and psychology and social science. But I think it's going to be a very interesting talk. Do you use a lot of statistics? I mean, I've heard of ANOVA and COVA, you use them.
Yeah, we use quite a lot. But the applications vary depending on how well people do it.
What's your favourite test so far?
Ooh, well, I'm doing correlations for my diss. So I have to stand by that.
Very good. Well, let's get on with the episode. I think it's very exciting that we have Liv here to talk about statistics, because we've done conversations on statistics, primarily on what statistics actually is. But we've not done so much about how statistics is actually used in the real world.
Yeah, we definitely mentioned stuff that statistics is used for. I remember saying galaxy formations, climate stuff, politics, those sorts of things. But I think a certain phrase that comes to mind when one thinks of statistics is, there are lies, damn lies, and statistics.
Too right.
And I think you wanted to talk about that, Liv, because I think it's fascinating to hear from a psychological perspective what these biases are.
Yeah, I mean, we have a lot of issues as a population.
As a population,
but also as a discipline. Psychologists have historically not been particularly honest when it comes to statistics, and there's quite a lot of issues with the existing data, which creates a lot of issues with us now for what we're currently creating, what standards we want to hold that to. And psychologists are also really against sharing data, which creates a massive problem, because when you come to do anything new, you don't really know what you're standing on, because people only present the very small window of what they think looks good.
Do you have any examples of this?
Well, practices are usually quite iffy. So it's like there was a study by Finelli in 2009 where they asked different scientists about whether they'd ever used questionable practices during their research, and 33.7% said that they had, and that include modifying results, using subjective data interpretation, missing things out, withholding analytical details to just basically twist the way that they were doing things to get it published, which is just like obviously a massive no-no, but no one can see that from your final written paper.
How long has this been going on for? Is it something that has only really come about because of the digital age of data information?
Well, there's actually this really interesting study in 2010. I can't remember the exact details about it, but it was about cognitive neuroimaging, and somebody tried to publish a study where they felt that they'd found evidence that we could, using our cognitive abilities, predict the future. And then other people were like, that doesn't sound very accurate. So it got absolutely torn apart, specifically around the statistics and the methodology that they used. So then as a result of that, psychology as a discipline was like, right, we need to actually go back through and see whether this is seen across the board. So they tried to replicate all of the work that we have, and only about like 36% was able to be replicated. And then for social sciences, that went straight down to 23%. It was pretty bad. So then it means a lot of the methodologies that we've been using and repeating just doesn't actually withstand what we think it's saying. And there's some like really key papers around that that show that just misuse of statistics has been used to sell people things that just aren't true.
So things about predicting the future, is that to do with you've taken a study and you've just done some kind of extrapolation with that? Or are there people trying to claim that they're fortune tellers and like, oh, look at all this data, look what I can do with it?
Well, it's a cognitive process, Seth. Your neurons fire before you actually make a decision. So they believe that shows that you can do something. You know the future of what's going to happen. Your body knows.
I think it might relate to the whole thing with determinism and free will over do we actually have some sort of conscious choice, or is it sort of already predetermined? Is it already predetermined for us because of these neurons?
Yeah.
I think it's an interesting discussion to have, but it's quite worrying that sort of the statistics for it were they fudged?
They looked back on it and they were like, the way that they'd scaled it didn't make sense. So what the conclusion that they'd made was based on something that wasn't actually true. So they'd come up with a stat, but when they'd actually looked into it, it didn't make sense. So it was a bit of that kicked off the whole replication crisis. And that is not just across psychology. And we're not actually the worst offenders. The worst discipline for replication was actually chemistry.
Oh, really?
Which is scary, if you think about it.
Because that's the subject where if you, I don't know, get a few chemicals wrong, you actually blow up the world. So.
Yeah.
Arguably,
yeah. Or hypothetically. I can't predict the future, so.
I think the design of experiments is something interesting to discuss. I'm looking forward to clinical trials for my next year module, and I think that will be fun to discuss the way trials and experiments are done. There's always the thing about questions. How do you ask certain questions in a statistical sense? Are they open? Are they closed? Have you experienced anything like that?
People often do this thing where they ask a loaded question. So that's where you ask a question to a participant, but you phrase it in a way where there is an obvious answer, if you like. So you phrase it in a way that when they receive the question, they can work out what you want them to say, so they're led to say that. It's very easy to basically get what you want out of a group of people if you know how to do it, which is not good science.
That's a shame, because I've got a book. Where is it?
Oh, dear.
I picked up a book last week, and it's actually called How to Lie with Statistics.
By Daryl Huff. Yes, I think I mentioned it. Bill Gates recommended it.
It's great. On the cover is a cute little picture that says, "Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?"
45.6% of the time. At least he's honest. It's always fun to point out people misleading and lying with statistics, mm-hmm. about graphs that are wrong or numbers that are fudged or cherry-picked is the classic example. But these things have real-world ramifications.
Yes.
Have you seen that?
Yeah. So I brought in some studies I thought you might find interesting that show real-world ramifications. It's difficult to talk about the extent because that's gone into quite detail, but I bet you've probably both heard of the MMR vaccine.
That was the paper that was talking about the spurious link between autism and the MMR vaccine.
Yeah.
But in actuality, the actual design of the experiment was bad. And of course, further studies have shown that there isn't one.
Yeah, well, the way it was designed was really poor. And it turned out that there was like very leading questions were used. So it was misleading in a lot of ways. If you read the paper, the paper's not primarily about that. And it links three very common conditions through subjective parent views. So his basis for making that connection was through what the parents felt. It was their subjective recall. So, and he based an entire finding, like this massive statistic finding, off basically a list of 10 people going yes or no. And it was very leading because obviously they just had these diagnoses. It was quite a very turbulent time. It was quite manipulative, the way that it was run. And also he had very large conflict of interest in running the paper, which kind of changes the whole perspective around it. But that caused mass hysteria, and loads of people then decided not to vaccinate their children because of fear of that. We do a lot around how you design a research question, how you design questionnaires for individuals. A very common practice is you won't actually make up your own questions. You use someone else's, and we have loads of tests to see whether they're fair, whether they're testing what you really think they're testing. But question choice is a massive issue in psychology. Going back to the whole loaded question thing. But also it depends on your sample. It's like some of these children were old enough to be in school, but some of them couldn't talk yet. So it's very variable as to what you're actually looking at and who you're actually looking at.
Because that's a whole other thing in making sure that whenever you do any kind of statistics, you want a sample size that is fair. One, you know, usually to get some kind of normal distribution, you get a sample size that is quite large, and you want to make sure you include everyone from every demographic. How is that done in experiments?
Well, that kind of is the issue. So we talk about this thing called a weird HM sample, but it's kind of samples that are white from a rich population that are heterosexual, which is a massive issue for us because you can't then generalise that to the whole population. For example, I'm doing my dissertation on children's tool innovation, and we were sampling in Newcastle and we had a massive issue because we were sampling in a science museum, and the only demographic of people coming to a science museum are people in a higher income bracket, which just isn't represent. We wanted to look at how socioeconomic status affects child tool innovation, so we couldn't see that across the board look. So we then can't claim that we understand that because that's not what we actually tested.
During our statistics podcast, Sam funnily mentioned the polling cockups that have played statistics and just how bad that is. But just because you poll loads of people, you do a big sample, doesn't mean it's going to be representative, surely. So there's a very funny example with an American election in 1936. There was a magazine called the Literary Digest who would conduct polls to try to predict the result of the election. And in that year, 1936, they sent 10 million questionnaires to see who would win. Would it be the Democratic incumbent, Roosevelt, or would it be the Republican challenger, Lanyon? That's a huge amount. 10 million is amazing.
Yeah.
Particularly back then. But you've probably seen the issue. The questionnaire would go to the people who'd get the magazine. So already there's sort of that sampling bias.
Yes.
There. But then you've also got a response bias, because you'd probably be more inclined to say that you'd vote for someone who wasn't the incumbent and try to get them out, rather than if you were supporting the incumbent.
You do always see that with voting, and that people will not bother to vote for the majority or the favouring party, or, you know, whatever you're voting in, because you know that's going to get the most votes anyway. And so that actually ruins the statistics anyway, and it all fluctuates.
One of the things that was pointed out was that, yes, they got them out, more than 2 million people responded, but those people were more likely to have subscriptions. They probably had telephones to answer the call. I think they also sent it to people with cars, aka people who could afford a car. So therefore, they were more likely to vote Republican. Therefore, the poll said that the Republican Lanyon would win.
Mm. Yeah.
He didn't. There was no President Lanyon. But we are seeing an improvement. Is there a sign that these things in sampling statistics has improved, Liv?
Yeah, I think there's definitely are improvements, but I think people are going to still have the belief that having a large sample size is inherently good, which just isn't true. Often we find that sometimes when you have a sample size so large, you get things amplified that would not be. If you keep looking and you look through all of the people that you can, you're at some point bound to find something, and that gets very heavily focused on. It's like sex and gender is a massive topic in the news at the moment, in current politics, and people are obsessed with finding specific differences between males and females and finding the truth and the right answers. And often we rely on these massive meta-analyses that have thousands and thousands of participants to support that. And, you know, you'll get these tiny effect sizes that show these differences. But then when you actually look at the small scale studies, it's just not consistent at all. And when you've got these groups of like 40, 50 participants, you're not seeing those effects across the board. It's just only when you look at massive groups of people that you see a really small effect. And that can be misleading, because then the media gets hold of that and it's like, we found this thing, but that it's not actually very well substantiated.
That sounds like an example of Simpson's paradox. Simpson's paradox is where, as a whole, a population might have a particular trend, but when you condition on certain levels within that population, whether it be sort of age or maybe income or class, that trend disappears or even reverses. Probably the famous example of this was UC Berkeley and their admission rate, and it was suggested that they might be biased towards men because they seem to have, on the whole, more men going in. But I think when they conditioned over either the departments or sort of their colleges, the trend disappeared and it seemed to be more women than men.
Interesting.
So that's definitely an example of just how, depending on where you look, there could be a paradox. But I think one of the things we should take from this is that it isn't really a paradox. We constantly mention, me and Sam, about all these different paradoxes, but I think in this example, it isn't a paradox. It's just the way that the data works. I think that is what I've been said.
Yeah. I think when people find things, they take a lot of comfort and a lot of truth in something that's been found, instead of taking it as a finding, if that makes sense. I think we talk a lot about facts and what are facts. And I think when people hear the word science and they hear statistics, they assume that that automatically means fact. Being critical of the information that you're looking at and understanding what the information is really important. It's like we often get a lot of people in psychology who overanalyze results. So like I read a paper a couple of weeks ago, and it was a massive paper, really influential, came out in 2014 about sex and gender differences, looking at structural differences in the brain. And, you know, they claim to have found these structural differences. And then in their discussion, they made a claim about behavior. And that was the thing that went viral. It was like, we found this solution for behavior, but they hadn't actually run any tests that correlated those two things, and they hadn't run an experimental manipulation, so they didn't really, it wasn't really cause to say those things, but because that made sense to people, they kind of ran with that, and that's been like the withstanding fact for a long time.
I wonder if that links to something mentioned a few weeks ago, which was the Fora effect, which is that if someone hears a statistic or a fact that is generalized, they automatically think it true to themselves.
Yeah.
So if in lots and lots of personality tests, you'll hear a statement that you might think is about you. You know, you could just go online on a BuzzFeed quiz and you think, oh, I've got this sentence, and your friend next to you also has that sentence, but you both think it's true to yourself. There's a lot of comfort in reading something and really trying to find a connection with it.
Yeah, definitely. Especially when we get lots of, you know, there's certain evidence that suggests males are better at maths and females are better at English and writing. And when you have a belief about yourself and then you see this thing and you're like, oh, this proves it, I think it's very hard to stay critical of the data.
It is an interesting one because of the few psychology lectures I have gatecrashed, the one I went to with Liv was about these sex and gender differences. And all these differences are misrepresented because most of the time it's actually a self-fulfilling prophecy. You just said that people find, or teachers have found, that boys are better at maths. Well, therefore, if they think they're better at maths, they'll be more inclined to teach the ones who are better at maths to lead them on, who are then going to teach more to do maths. It's a whole cyclic reasoning.
Yeah, we got some really interesting data on stereotyping about how if you tell women before they take a maths test that women are not very good at maths, they generally do worse than if they're not primed. So there's a lot of like social context around it. And, you know, we talk a lot about how biology is a bit of a social construct itself, because we only ever know as much as we think we know about it, as much as we've discovered. And especially when it comes to sex and gender, there's lots of debates over where the fact is. You know, you can't lie with biology, but that means that, you know, social factors, environmental factors, psychological factors are often very heavily discounted, which is not true, because the evidence is just as strong, the statistics is just as true. But people see biology at the front of it and they automatically believe it because biology must be right.
It is quite disturbing to hear this sort of misuse of statistics. And I always get the feeling that, is it dumb because it's all about getting statistics in the news and in the papers?
Yeah, because instead of saying, what are the statistics, we actually ask, what is statistics?
But I think we need to return to the original question, what are the statistics, and just exactly how are they made?
Something that you mentioned to me on the walk down, Liv, was that in a lot of studies, they will do a test, or they'll ask a question, ask a yes or no question. And in this specific example, there were 20 people asked, and 19 of them said yes. And therefore, 19 out of 20 is a figure you can give. This 95% is something you can give. Yes, that is a statistic, but what does that actually represent? Because it's often, you know, it's often mistreated.
Yeah, so the 20 people and 19 saying yes, you know, you can then say 95% of participants, bang. And you don't, you know, you can record in your fine print what that is. But if you're making an advertisement, how many people are actually going to read that?
Is this related to 9 out of 10 dentists recommend a certain...
I was going to say toothpaste. There have been quite a few lawsuits around toothpaste.
Who knew?
Surrounding that thing. Because people, and that comes back to the questions. Because often people, dentists will be asked, do you like this product? Not, is this product the best? Or would you recommend this product? how many times have you used this product? And it's very, the wording is very ambiguous. So then you can make your advertisements very ambiguous.
There are times that when people say, oh, and this many people recommend it, they do actually leave a sample size and then like, we asked this many people. And I thought, oh, that's very interesting. So it's probably a sign that they're actually trying to say, no, this isn't a universal thing.
Yes.
Every single dentist
definitely
in the world.
Won't be.
That sounds good.
Yeah.
So I think there's a sign of improvement. Now, Liv, you mentioned something about replicating experiments. And how was it? 33.7% was replicated?
Yeah, we got something like, I think it was like 36% replicated, which is very low. And that's only overall. If you go into like individual sections of psychology, the highest replication we had in a subgroup was only 53%. And that was the biological aspect that, you know, that was cognitive experiments. Social psychology, that went down to 23%, which is a really big problem because everything that we try and apply in the real world around psychology, you know, comes from that social psychology. And that replication just doesn't exist.
So you're saying that there's some sort of crisis approaching?
Oh, massively. And what makes it even more difficult is scientists won't share their data. So we can't even go back in and be like, right, what actually went wrong here? See the raw data files. All we have is the statistics that they've published in their paper, which is usually very, very limited. You don't see they'll describe the tests that they've run, but you can't see anything other than what has been cherry-picked, like you said earlier. And that's actually led to a new thing that psychology is doing called the Open Science Framework, where everyone registers their study and then uploads their data as they do it so that other people can see it and replicate it alongside them, which is a nice improvement, I think.
Is that the best way to solve it, or are there other things about the way that p-hacking is done?
Well, that's the thing. It's really difficult to track these things without people actually being honest about them. So p-hacking is when you manipulate your data analysis so that you can find, basically, you keep doing analysis until you find a statistically significant result. And harking is when you run a load of tests and then you make your hypothesis after you've run the tests so that you can basically create this molded package however you want it to look. But I think a big reason why that's happening, especially in my area, is because journals will only publish if you find a significant result.
Yeah, it's not really newsworthy that everything is okay. Is
exactly. And for academics, you can't do anything unless you've got publications. So there is this massive pressure on individuals, and that's why p-hacking and harking comes into it. Because, I mean, I guess some people feel like they don't have a choice. But then that completely changes the way that our science is being done.
So what's the solution to p-hacking and harking?
Well, I think the Open Science Framework is a good start. It means that we're sharing, we're talking. Because I think also people are very scared about, you know, research being taken. But that allows for good open communication. It also means we can test more samples. Because if you've got your data online, then somebody in Germany who's got a completely different sample can test it. You know, and you can see whether you're getting similar results or whether there's something wrong with the generalizability, whether that doesn't work. But also journals have now started this new thing where you send in your hypothesis and they approve it. And if they approve it, they have to publish no matter what results you get, which is obviously a good step forward because it means hopefully that'll stop p-hacking.
If there's one statistical phrase that people probably have heard as well as damn lies and statistics, it would definitely be correlation does not imply causation. And I think the discussion of correlation within statistics is very interesting. I think you mentioned it as well with your...
Yeah, I mean, I brought some funny correlations just because I thought you might find them amusing. So milk consumption is correlated with the divorce rate in Colorado.
Really?
And I have to say my favorite one because this site, they actually ran this, like they did the full analysis and they have the values. Associate degrees awarded in mental health professions is correlated with the number of vending machine repairs in Mississippi. And the p-value for that was 0.1. The correlation value was 0.969, which is really high, really close to one, which is, I mean...
What kind of hypotheses could you draw from that?
I think you'd have to probably start inferring a lot of stuff about the relation between, what was it, milk and...
The first one was milk and divorce rate in Colorado.
Well, you know what it's like when you're taking the bottle of milk and going out to the pub, dairy.
Well, this is our friend Tasha's personal favourite. The number of people who drown by falling into a swimming pool is positively correlated with the number of films Nicolas Cage has appeared in.
How would you even measure that? Because there's an objective number. Does it mean by year?
Yes. Yeah, they have the years, yeah.
So, you know, the more and more Nick Cage got popular, the more people wanted to drown themselves. I think that's the takeaway.
Clearly. Yeah, so it's just like, you know, you look at that. If I ran a test, and the one that I said before about the vending machines, if I ran a test and I got a p-value of 0.01, and then the correlational value of 0.969, like, I would be really happy.
And you'd want to publicise that.
Yeah.
And promote that and say, I've done something.
So the fact that, you know, mental health professionals' degrees and number of vending machines is getting that and I'm not is kind of sad. That's the way that works, I guess. But yeah, another issue with correlation is people leave things out. So an interesting one that I was looking at is drinking tea increases diabetes. You know, that's...
Why are you looking at me, Sam?
God help us all. Louis, I'm sorry.
Sam made me drink 8 teas on the Statistics podcast.
I did.
Wait, one podcast?
Yeah. Well, it was in the behind the scenes, which will not get released purely because it didn't happen. But there's a whole thing of Louis brought out a tray that had 8 teas in it, and it was a sort of hypothesis testing. Could I tell which ones had milk first or tea first?
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so if 4 of them, yeah, if half of them had milk first and 4 of them did tea first, you know, how would I be able to tell? If I picked randomly, you know, what kind of tests can you draw from that? And then we had to get rid of it by the end, and so clearly Louis had to drink them all. That was the only logical option.
Podcasting is thirsty work.
It is. So tea and diabetes, should we be scared? Or?
Yeah, so, you know, that's a very media headline, you know. We see things like that all the time, these flashy statistics. They fail to mention the fact that, what about the amount of sugar an individual puts into their tea? That would be a lot more interesting thing if you're looking at diabetes. You know, I think as a professional, you would care a lot more about that than about the tea, but that's not going to sell. You know, so we do very much cherry pick the things that we focus on. So a real life example is there was a bit of a craze over a finding a couple of years ago around schizophrenia in cats. So they found the link between this bacteria and it increased your risk of schizophrenia twofold, and it was found on your cats. So suddenly you're getting titles like kids with cats have more than double the risk of developing schizophrenia, researchers say. Like, you know, it's scary if you hear that. However, they fail to mention all the other risk factors of schizophrenia and how small your risk factor of actually getting schizophrenia really is. And if you experience something like abuse, for example, your risk of schizophrenia goes up 50-fold. So when you compare that to your risk from cats, it's not really the same. But that's what the media wants to look at.
Well, I'll definitely be more careful around cats then. I know Sam is already.
Yeah, well, everyone knows that cats land on their feet. If you throw a cat off a X meter tall wall, they'll land on their feet.
That's fair. My cat fell 3 stories and landed on her feet.
There we go. Congratulations. You also know that you have a piece of toast and you butter it and, oh no, you've lost grip and you drop the toast. It's more often than not going to land butter side down.
Right. I know you guys do maths, but like, how do you know it lands butter side down?
Well, it's because butter weighs it down. Butter's heavier on one side, so it weighs it down.
Okay.
And so what happens if you strap a piece of buttered toast to a cat? Which way would it land?
Is the butter facing up? Is it cat toast,
well,
butter?
If you stuck the buttered side.
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm not like just putting butter onto a cat.
These things with correlations are absolutely fascinating. I think there's always one that it mixes the whole sampling thing with the correlation. So have you ever heard the idea that the more attractive someone is, the less nice they are, and vice versa, that the less attractive they are, they're actually quite nice.
I've heard similar things, one of them being, in terms of humour, you know, if a more attractive person would tell a joke, doesn't matter if it's funny or not, on average, they get more laughs out
yes.
of it.
Yeah.
And it's because, you know, people do, unfortunately, judge books by their covers. And they see that, okay, this is an attractive person. I want them to like me. Therefore, I should laugh at everything they say because humor is attractive. Whereas the ones who are deemed less attractive, even if they are really good at comedy, they'll get less laughs because it's like, oh, ugh, you know. That's a strange way of putting it, but you know what I'm saying.
Basically, this relates to something called Bergson's paradox, which is the idea that the way that we sort of sample our statistics suggests that there's some sort of negative correlation, where in actuality there isn't one. Because think, you never want to consider someone who is both unattractive and not nice. And therefore, because you miss that out of your statistics, because you don't consider them, you just change the correlation, and therefore you get a negative line.
Yeah, that's like what I was saying before about the tea, yeah.
Think of something else, like you're going out to a restaurant and you know that in town there are places that do good pizza and bad chips, but then there are other places that do good chips but bad pizza. You're not really going to consider the ones that do bad pizza and bad chips. Therefore, you just get this negative correlation where one doesn't really exist.
The whole thing, the axes are skewed because you've just missed off information.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You and your paradoxes.
I know. It's also known as collider bias, which is something about two potential causes for the same issue.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, but considering that this is the sciences, there are probably so many, as you said, so many factors to be considered.
Yeah.
It's like with the tea thing, there is just an extra factor that people are missing out. There's a certain number of people who have sugar with their tea, and then some sort of correlation between sugar and diabetes. But what they've done is completely missed the mark on that and just drawn the straight conclusion.
Yeah.
When it's not, you know, it's not feasible at all.
Mm-hmm.
People are choosing the statistics they want to use.
Also, we make a lot of assumptions. We have a lot of biases. We often think that we're right a lot. And, you know, when you see something that logically makes sense, you're very inclined to believe it. And, you know, the media wants to sell the wow factor, but often there's an explanation behind it that makes sense, if that makes sense.
It does. It was very, very logically said as well, so I follow that. I believe it to be true.
Do you think that we might benefit from encouraging people to actually read the data itself?
I think definitely. I think sex and gender, going back to that, really opened my eyes around that. And the way that the data is used in the media and the misconceptions and the beliefs that people hold, I didn't realise how drastically different they were to what the data is actually saying. And I think anyone who actually studies it doesn't see it like that. Obviously, there's like an honesty perspective of what the media is putting out, but also there seems to be like a misunderstanding and a misunderstanding about what science is and what statistics is. So people think when they see something, it's very conclusive, but there's loads of things you've got to consider, like the effect size, the sample. It's not just as simple as, oh, we found this thing, therefore this thing is right, it means everything.
It's a thing a lot of people complain about with fake news, and that, oh, here's a statistic, 83% of statistics are made up. You know, there's lots of fake news that goes about, especially in the context of celebrities and what you can quote them on. I mean, this isn't directly statistics related, but it's the fact that you can look up on the internet quotes by famous people, and it's just a black and white photo of them with a quote that they've never said. Like, there'll be something about computers that Archimedes would have said, but that's just not true because Archimedes wasn't around for computers. And so it made me think, like, how long after someone is dead are you allowed to misquote them?
Misquoting people is always going to be bad because you put them out of context, you just change what they're saying, just ruins the argument. It's more of an appeal to authority, I'd argue, because what you're saying is, ah, yes, but as this famous novelist / politician / poet once said, X, someone should just say, feel free to use this in any argument or quotation, I will believe you, and that should be the quote.
Well, that's just as damaging to media as is faking statistics. Because you know, you can misquote a statistic and there will not be enough people to click on the extra link to actually look at the data. There will not be enough people who read the end of the article. So you could put out any statistic out there and a lot of people will just believe it.
Yeah. Also, when things are disputed, that's usually really difficult to do. So, for example, like the autism MMR paper, he was disputed pretty heavily, pretty quickly.
Yeah.
But by that point, the effect had already been had. And the general population does not understand the jargon and the inner workings of breaking down that methodology, and other psychologists saying, well, I don't agree with this, this wasn't done right. You know, that part for the everyday person, nobody's going to look into that. And, you know, the paper didn't get removed from the journal until, I think it was like 2012.
Wow.
So it was up for a long time and anyone can look it up and see it. You know, you're only going to see the information that is given to you in a way that you can understand, I think. The very interesting thing, going back again to the sex and gender stuff, the thing that really blew my mind, there is evidence of sex and gender differences, and a lot of them are really useful. For example, for medicine, females need a very different dosage of certain medications, and often in medical science, they only use samples of men, and they try and apply it to both. And I can't remember what it was called, but there was a SEPA medication that was approved, and then there was a group of women that overdosed on it because it was just too high for the female body. So clearly there's very, very important distinctions and applications to be made, but that's not the side that people are seeing. They're seeing this kind of very strong view of the negatives that the media are putting out instead of seeing it. I think the perspective needs to shift on the statistics, if that makes sense.
Yeah, right.
It's about understanding the information and being critical with the information and not just seeing what you want to see.
In the world of biases then, it's often done by subjective belief, in that the way we're brought up kind of shifts or shapes how we think, how we're meant to think. So in terms of critical thinking, or at least critical analysis of any data you see, how should that be implemented, you know, to the younger generation so that they're brought up with maybe less bias?
I think that's a really difficult question to answer because, you know, if in context of sex and gender, I did not understand, if you like, how I felt about it until I did the module and I looked at the data, because it is so tricky to kind of decipher from the information that we're told that it is kind of, it's really difficult to see what it means and to form an opinion if you don't have those facts. Talking about science more from a younger age, like very more concepts, I think would probably be very important. Because I think at home, you're always going to have politics. People are always going to have beliefs and views. But kind of being exposed to a wider range of things, I think often we learn quite set things when we're younger. I think it would be nice to introduce a lot more topics. I know that I learned a lot coming here that I didn't even realise existed. And the way that we view things that I didn't even realise existed. I think maybe, again, the perception on things needs to shift a bit. But also, I think statistics is a lot more important than people give it credit for.
Nope, not true.
Source,
me. on this, who should we believe? Lies, damn lies, and statistics. Who came up with that quote? You and your quotes.
Well, here's the weird thing. The phrase itself seemed to be popularized by Mark Twain, the famous American novelist. But he himself attributed it to one of the old prime ministers, Benjamin Disraeli. But no one can find that quote in his work. So maybe Mark Twain just made it up himself. But we don't know.
You don't know for sure.
There have been other people who suggested, but I don't know. It's one of those, a phrase that has been lost to time.
Perhaps we could try and replicate it in the future.
To wrap up, I think I might end with a quote myself. So Arnold Relman said, science is at once the most questioning and sceptical of activities and also the most trusting.
Because we do put a lot of trust in scientists.
Yeah, and some of them clearly are not doing it right.
All right. And with that, I think it's best to end our discussion.
Thank you, Liv, for a very interesting conversation about statistics. I can't believe it, finally. Well, not finally.
Finally, we got to statistics.
Finally, we got to statistics.
finally, we get to see the use of statistics. So there's some experimental evidence of what Louis is studying. Can't say the same about me, unfortunately.
Math bio.
No, math bio, maybe. But no, it's been a very, very enlightening topic. So thank you, Liv, for coming on today to talk with us.
Thank you. I really enjoyed myself.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Trollboard Ultra. We hope you found it as enlightening as we did.
For more great content and to listen to more things, head over to the Spotify playlist, link in the Chalkboard Ultra on Instagram and Twitter.
As always, keep safe and keep well.
Myself for this podcast, I thought I'm gonna try to find a book to talk about. You know, maybe it'd be nice to sort of actually know what Liv is coming to speak with us about. So I went to the psychology section in the Billy B, and I was like, okay, memory, perception, sleeping, dreaming. I'm thinking, this is not helping me.
They're all the worst topics.
Why can't it just be like statistics? So then I went to the math part and I thought, ah, okay.
I'm home.
Fields, rings, astronomy, time series. I'm thinking, I don't think this is helping either.
No. Because statistics, is that just like a small section in the Billy B? Or?
It's a few sections, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
But there's just so much of it because you've got time series, you've got game theory, you've got Bayesian analysis, you've got like books on R, you've got the history of statistics. I think I tried reading that.
I might as well read a sleeping book because that is. I just yawned during that. God. I knew you'd perk up to that.
Oh, God.
We need to replicate that in the
podcast.
Oh, God. No. I don't want you to start make psychology puns now.
But I don't know them. That's the thing. I don't know anything about psychology.
I don't know any.
Well, I went to the Billy B and I didn't understand anything. I was like, what the hell am I doing?
But now, if that is not a universal experience, then I don't know what is.
Purple Radio Podcasts.
Thanks for downloading this Purple Radio podcast. For more great content and to listen live, head to purpleradio.co.uk.